I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen, and on today's show, we have an interview with a guy who was a former teenage champion. His name is George Betancourt, and George lives right out here in Florida and got very good results very quickly and was a top teenage competitor. He won both the Teenage Mr. USA and also the Teenage America. And he did that all before he was 18 years old. And then George won the overall at the MPC Southern States, which is held in Miami, Florida, one of the biggest regional-level contests in the country. And he did it at 19 years old. He's the only teenager to ever win an overall at the Southern States. So George is an old-school bodybuilder, like a lot of us, and got a lot of great views on old-school bodybuilding. And it's going to be an interesting interview to hear about how bodybuilding was for teenagers back in the 1980s. So we got that interview coming up in a minute. After we talk to George, I'm going to read another article sent to us again by my friend Pat Comer. And it's about Robbie Robinson. It's a personality piece on Robbie Robinson that appeared in the September 1979 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. And I remember this article from when I was a kid, but I haven't seen it in so long. So it's great that Pat sent that to us. So I'm going to read that right after our interview with George Betancourt. And this will be part one of our interview with George. We'll have part two next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, before we get to that, I do want to mention our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. It's the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe in 2012. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner called Vintage Burn. It's the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner. Or Vintage Blast, which is the two-stage pre-workout. Or Vintage Brawn, which is the triple protein isolate powerhouse. It's packed with eggs, milk, and beef protein. Their products have no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. Old School Labs is also the home of 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Benoot and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to their website, oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, before we talk about the Arnold Classic, which was just this last weekend, I do want to mention again my seminar, which is coming up next weekend. It's already here, September 21st and 22nd out here in Tampa, Florida. It'll be a two-day seminar that's going to cover all aspects of bodybuilding, training, nutrition, how to set up a training routine, how to set up a diet, bulking up, getting cut up, everything. We will cover everything because we're going to have 2 days to talk about it. And the first part of the day will be instruction in the classroom. And then the second part of the day will be in the gym, where I will show you one-on-one what exercises to do. So I'm offering a special 2-for-1 because this is the first time I'm doing this, and you can bring two people for the price of one. So if you go to johnhansenfitness.com, you can sign up, and if you're in the Florida area or even if you're not in the Florida area, I hope you can come down, and if this is for you, I hope you can make it. I think flights are pretty cheap right now, actually, because of this coronavirus that's going on. So if you're out of state, you might be able to get a cheap flight. And if you want to email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, I can give you some suggestions on where to stay when you're in the area. And we're filling up pretty good. We're almost at our capacity, but we do have some openings. So if you guys want to come out, I would really appreciate seeing you, and I'd love meeting you. It's going to be a great seminar. I'm going to put a lot into it. And this will be the first, hopefully, of many seminars to come this year in 2020. So again, that's johnhansenfitness.com. And if you sign up, you will get the 2-for-1 special. You don't have to put anything special on there. And you can bring whoever you want. You want to bring your training partner or a family member or your spouse or loved one. Doesn't matter. Just come on down and be at the seminar. I'd really love to see you guys. All right. Well, let's talk about the Arnold Classic. As you guys know, as I mentioned last week, I was supposed to go out to the Arnold Classic. I had all my reservations and everything. But last Tuesday, which was only 2 days before the Arnold Classic started on Thursday, they canceled the expo. And this was because of concerns of the coronavirus. I guess it was actually citizens from Columbus, Ohio, that signed a petition, and they brought it to the governor's office and the mayor's office. And then the pressure was on, so they had to call up Arnold and Jim Lorimer and all the promoters of the Arnold Classic, and they decided to cancel the expo. And then they did go on and hold some of the athletic events. All the bodybuilding events went on, and it was confusing on what was going on. First, they were saying there was going to be no spectators. Then they were saying, if you had a ticket, come on down, there would be spectators. So I guess they did have spectators, at least at the evening show on Saturday night. The prejudging events that I saw on YouTube, it looked like there was hardly anybody in the audience. It looked like it was just maybe the competitors themselves who were sitting in the audience and the judges. So really, really kind of a real messed up weekend for the Arnold Classic. This obviously never happened before. A lot of people were put out, especially all the vendors who were supposed to be at the expo, as well as all the people who were supposed to be there. That event, of course, brings in huge money to Columbus, Ohio. I think I read somewhere where it was like 37% of their annual income or annual revenues comes in from that Arnold Classic every year. So it was a huge blow to the economy of Columbus, Ohio. I'm sure nobody wanted this to happen, but unfortunately it did happen. So I decided to cancel my trip because the only reason I was going out there was to do interviews for this podcast. And I was hoping to catch a lot of the old school bodybuilders at the expo. But since the expo is going to be canceled, I figured there's no sense in me going out there. But I did watch the contest on YouTube for free. So that was great. It was live all weekend. And they really got that down now. I remember when you used to have to go to a website to watch the live broadcast. And there was always problems with that. But now it's great. It's right on YouTube. Anybody can watch it right on their phone. I went out and celebrated my friend Eddie's birthday Saturday night. And I was watching it on my phone right from the table. So it was great. Yeah, I guess we can go over some of the results from that really quick. And the men's bodybuilding, of course, the big winner was William Bonack, who won this contest, I think, 2 years ago. And I saw William at the Olympia last year. This guy has just an incredible physique. He's very short, but he's super thick and super dense. And if you see him up close, this guy is just an incredible physique. And he's always in shape. Even when he's off, he's not that off that much. He was second in the Olympia last year, so of course he would have been the front runner, because Brandon Curry was not in the contest. So William did win this contest, and deservedly. Yeah, I thought he won it pretty easily, actually. When I was watching the prejudging on YouTube and they were doing the comparisons, I thought nobody was close to this guy. He's just got so much thickness. He doesn't have the best structure, and he's actually pretty short and kind of squatty, but it doesn't matter because he's got so much thickness and so much hardness, and he was just ahead of the pack. And Dexter Jackson, 50 years old, he turned 50 last December. He took second place. This will be Dexter's last year competing. He was amazing, too. I thought he looked better here than he did at the Olympia. He looked leaner, very lean. His face was super lean. Still got an amazing body. And he was very close with Big Rami. Big Rami was making his comeback because he didn't compete last year. This was going to be his big comeback. And I don't think he ever did the Arnold before. And he looked very, very good, Big Rami did. He was more conditioned than I can remember seeing him. But he still could have been more conditioned than he was. He's so big. He's so wide. His legs are so big. He could even bring down his muscle mass a little bit. But if he came in really dry and really ripped, I don't think anybody could beat this guy because there's so much size there. So he was a little bit off, and then Dexter pulled ahead of him at the night show. I think they were tied at the prejudging after two rounds, and then Dexter pulled ahead at the night show by 1 point. So it was very close. But deservedly so. Dexter was in amazing shape, and he got a standing ovation at the night show after his posing routine because this will be his last Arnold Classic, at least in Columbus. I think he's going to go to Australia and also Brazil, I believe, and do the Arnold Classic there too. Amazing competitor Dexter Jackson is. We really all should take our hat off to him. I don't think that'll ever be done again where someone could be that old and compete for that long. His first year as a pro was 1999, so he's been in this for a long time. The other guys were Steve Kuklo from Texas, took fourth place. Steve is another really impressive physique, a real big guy, very wide, has a great structure, tall, wide, great legs, and really good condition. For me, it doesn't look like his abs are super sharp. If he had that, I think he'd be really good. But other than that, he's really in condition all over the rest of his body. And he did very good at the Olympia last year, too. So this was he had the momentum from that going into this. And then he took fourth place, so he did really, really good. And then Sergio Oliva Jr. was fifth. And that was one of the highlights of the contest for me when I was watching it, was Sergio gave a really great posing routine and he won the Best Poser Award. And Arnold presented him with the Best Poser Award. And then Arnold was reminiscing about competing with Sergio Oliva, his father, in 1970, 50 years ago, in Columbus, Ohio, at the Mr. World Contest. And that was really, really nice. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it. Arnold and Sergio were two legends in the sport competing against each other 50 years ago. And now his son is on the Arnold Classic stage as a bodybuilder. And if you remember, of course, back to 1984, when Sergio Jr. was an infant, and then Sergio brought him up on stage when he made his comeback at the 1984 Olympia. And now here we are all these years later, and Sergio Jr. is now in the contest and competing. It's really amazing when you think about it. I never would have predicted this. So anyway, Sergio Jr. was in amazing shape. He was the biggest I've ever seen him, and also very good condition. So he is really bringing his physique up over the years. I remember seeing him, I think it was back in 2008, they had a event, Iron Age, that website I used to follow. Iron Age was there, and Jeff Preston, who ran the site or helped run the site, they had a booth at the expo at the Arnold Classic. So Bill Grant was there, and who else was there? I think Steve Mihalik was there, and then Sergio was there. We got Sergio to come, and then Sergio Jr. was there, and I remember him. He was very young, of course, and real lean. You could tell he had some muscle, but nothing like the bodybuilder he is today, of course. He really wasn't a bodybuilder. He was just getting into bodybuilding, and we were all excited about that. And so now here he is, Sergio Oliva Jr., top five at the Arnold Classic. So that was really cool to see. And then Cedric McMillan rounded out the top six. Cedric, of course, as I said many times on this podcast, has probably the greatest potential of anyone. Incredible structure and full round muscle bellies. Reminds me like of Lee Haney, like a bigger version of Lee Haney. And he's just an amazing bodybuilder. But he just kind of does his own thing. And he's very laid back. And a lot of times he just doesn't consider winning these contests is very important. He doesn't have the drive that he would hope he would have. So anyway, Cedric was off and still looked great, I thought. And even his posing routine at night, he just didn't seem to put a lot into it. He's usually a really good poser. He didn't seem to be inspired. So maybe he's just losing the drive to do this. He is getting a little bit older. He just looks at life and at bodybuilding a little bit differently than most people. I think a lot of people who would have his genetic potential would be winning the Olympia, and Cedric could be Mr. Olympia and Arnold Classic winner anytime he wants, because that's the kind of genetics he has. As big as Big Ramy is, I think Cedric could beat him, you know, with the size and the physique, because he's just got so much gifts in his physique. So it's a shame, but it's always great to see him on stage, and it was good to see his posing routine, even though it was limited. And if you ever see any interviews with Cedric, he's great. He's the best, because he just, like I said, he has a whole different viewpoint on bodybuilding. So that was the Arnold Classic, and then they had the Arnold Classic Classic Physique also. And Alex Campanero, who's from Florida, looked amazing. Man, this guy used to do 212, and he's so much better now in the Classic Physique. Very, very small waist, real sharp, good vacuum, just really sharp lines, and I thought he was the winner all the way. But Terrence Ruffin, who is from Tampa, Florida, who I've met before, really nice guy. Terrence has got amazing physique also, and this was the best he ever looked. Really dialed in, and another really great physique. There's so many great physiques in this Classic Physique division. It's really an exciting division. And Terrence was a really good poser, even a better poser than Sergio. So it's great to see guys like Terrence and Sergio Jr. really working on their posing and trying to make it better. So I hope more guys do that. Steve Laureus was in third in that event. He's from New York, big, tall, black guy. Another amazing, amazing physique. When you see pictures of this guy, like, how can anybody even beat him? His waist is so small. He's got wide shoulders, big arms, big thighs. There's just so many great physiques in that Classic Physique division. It's just going to get better and better. So if you guys, even you old school guys who don't follow bodybuilding, you should check out some of these Classic Physique competitions, because they really do have some amazing bodybuilders in there. All right, our interview last week with Gary Bartlett went very well. A lot of people like that. I put it up on YouTube, as I'm putting all my podcasts now on YouTube. So if you follow YouTube, just search my name, John Hansen. You should be able to find my page, and you can subscribe to it, because each week I'm going to be putting up these podcasts up on YouTube, and I add pictures and stuff. So it takes a while to put these together, but they're really, really cool to see. So check that out. But I did put on Facebook, I announced the podcast for last week with Gary Bartlett. And I got some comments on my Facebook page. Lee Haney himself, 8-time Mr. Olympia, was the first one to comment. Thank you, Lee. I know Lee follows the podcast. And he said, wow, this is some great history. So thank you, Lee, for that comment. Shad Paneska said, I enjoyed Muscle Mag International when Bob was around in charge. Those pics of my idols in the 80s and 90s were awesome. The great Lee Haney and natural Mr. O, John Hansen, to be chatting, to be a fly on the wall. Gary Bartlett himself said, always a great pleasure being featured on John's show. He has fantastic interviewing skills, and his passion for bodybuilding really comes across in well-researched questions. And then Samir Banut said, I love Bob. Rest in peace. Terry Strand said, I sold an article to Bob Kennedy for $300. A good guy. Sergio Moshia said, Muscle Mag was the best. Janet O'Hara said, great stuff. Moisey Richardson said, I used to buy that magazine every month religiously. And Eric Burke said, two great interviews with Gary. I love Muscle Mag too. These interviews with the people that worked with and around the bodybuilding legends are as fascinating as the interviews with the legends themselves. All right. Thank you guys for those comments. Also, on my Old School Labs page on Facebook, I got a comment from Mark Keegan who said, man, I miss Muscle Mag. Very nice to see Mr. Kennedy recognized for his contributions to bodybuilding. I was a 10-year subscriber. Wow. And then, as I said, I put this interview on my YouTube page. And so Gary Bartlett Part 2 is now a video on my YouTube page. I got 16 comments on that. Shaq said, I miss the days when you had the choice of numerous bodybuilding magazines in every shop. Bob Kennedy's Beef It is a book that everyone should own. Stefanos Prokopis said, I was so addicted to Muscle Mag International. I remember once I bought a copy and I was ecstatic. Then I got in the truck that I used to drive, all excited to read during my long shift, realizing I forgot it on some bench. I almost had a nervous breakdown as I didn't have the money to buy another copy. But I really love that mag, and the 80s Muscle and Fitness was also always great. Another enjoyable interview. And this guy said, did you find your magazine? He said, no, it was forever lost. Hey, maybe some young kid found it and got into bodybuilding and ended up becoming Mr. Olympia. You just never know. And then another guy said, it could have saved someone from an unhealthy life and got them into working out. Someone named Iron Man said, I was an avid reader of Muscle Mag International back in the early 90s. Each issue was always a great read. Flex Magazine was okay, but it wasn't quite the same level of professionalism in terms of content and the way it was written. Benny Salin said, I remember Muscle Mag being good in the early to mid 90s, but it seemed like half of it was ads. Madden Shetty said, all this stuff is like gold dust. I love it. Thank you for bringing it to us, John. Stefan Prokopis said, it's sad how Bob ended up, for a man who was always into health and fitness, to die of a disease that generally results from unhealthy living. And then someone else said, he did smoke cigars, unfortunately. Nice guy, however. The Spritz said, John, I love listening to Frank Zane all day, but he blamed any injury or contest loss on, oh, I couldn't train that heavy or that intense anymore. He actually was never injured in the gym, only outside of the gym by his pool cutting open his leg near his crotch and those bicycle accidents starting in 1983. I believe he fell off his bike on his shoulder. I was going to leave you a comment when you did the first interview, but I was in a great mood, so I just let it fly. But you're right on the money there. And the Zane look was so attractive to the general public, not so much with Yates and Forward. And then this comment, 100% agreed with the 1983 Mr. O. Samir looked untouchable, incredible. You just knew that he had it. Samuel Clemens said, great era, great memories. Thank you, John. And Eric Larkin said, great episode, John and Gary. Thanks. All right. Thank you for your comments, guys. Like I said, if you want to make a comment, if you don't do it on YouTube, you can email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I will read your comment on the air if you want. Or you can just leave it on my Facebook page, as so many people are doing. All right. And also on my YouTube channel, I also have a new back and bicep workout. So if you guys are enjoying checking out my workouts, I'm putting my workouts up on YouTube each week. Usually I'm putting at least one video up there a week with plans to do more. So check that out and subscribe to my YouTube channel. This is a back and bicep workout. And this week I'm going to be doing a chest and back superset. So you might want to check that out too. So that'll be up there sometime this week. All right, before we get to our interview with George Betancourt, I also want to mention our other sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to your maximum potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals. and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number, 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, flalternativemeds.com. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast and mention Jeff, and they will give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right, so here is our interview with George Betancourt, one of the top teenage champions. He was a phenomenon in the bodybuilding world back in the 1980s. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. My very special guest this week is George Betancourt. George was one of the top teenage competitors in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and he is a big believer in old school bodybuilding. So we're happy to have you on the show, George. How you doing?
How you doing, John?
Good. Well, George, let's talk about your bodybuilding career. As I said, I think I told you this before, I moved to Tampa like 10 years ago, and I was covering a lot of the NPC shows in Florida, and when I would go to the Miami area where you're from, they would still talk about you. You know, it's like you're still a legend in the sport because you made such a big impact, you know, when you were competing. So talk about, like, when you got into bodybuilding. What was your interest in getting into bodybuilding?
Well, I think the interest came from watching my father. When I was a kid, you know, maybe 5, 6 years old, in Puerto Rico, you used to store your trash, not trash, but your junk, on top of your rooftops. The rooftops in Puerto Rico were flat.
Okay.
And I remember my father used to have some type of dumbbells or barbell up there, maybe even a bench. And I used to remember my father every once in a while go up there to do something, you know, to do some type of workout. I don't even think I saw him work out, but I remember that's what it was for.
Okay.
And ever since I was a kid, I always thought that working out or exercising was part of being a man. Like you had to have muscles and be strong to be a man, which is totally wrong, but it's just what I thought at that age. I thought that being a man required muscles, you know. I was, I guess, like a caveman kind of thing, you know. I had that caveman mentality. Right. I really did, you know.
Right.
I had that caveman mentality, you know. You go hunt and bring the cattle home by the horns, you know,
right,
that type
right.
of thing, you know.
Right.
You beat them up with a, like from the cartoons too, you know.
Right. So you were born in Puerto Rico, George, and then you guys moved to Miami?
Yeah, my parents were from Cuba.
Okay.
And they left in 56 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Around before the Fidel stuff.
Yeah.
When they saw Fidel coming, they left and they moved over there.
Okay.
I have two older brothers. They're not into weight training. And so they moved over there, and I was born in 1971.
Okay.
My parents, so I lived in an island till 1979 or 80.
Oh, wow. Know? Okay. All right. And then you guys moved to Miami?
Yeah. I literally lived across the beach. Like I would go down my apartment, because everybody lives there in apartments.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I would go down and cross the street, and I would be on the beach. My father used to go spear fishing sometimes, not every day, sometimes after school when I would get home, and he would get home from work, or maybe he got home early, and he would go across the street and go spear fishing and catch dinner.
Yeah.
Crazy, man.
What does your dad do for a living?
Well, my father, when he moved here to Miami, he didn't speak English. But being here in Miami, it was fine at that time. So he was a car car salesman.
Okay. Gotcha.
In Cuba, he used to be a pharmaceutical rep. So he will go from pharmacy to pharmacy selling drugs, I guess.
Yeah.
Medicine.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, when my father found out that I was taking steroids, he wasn't surprised by what it was. My mom was shocked. My mom was shocked.
Right.
Yeah, my mom was shocked. But my father has seen that in Cuba. Mm. And imagine in Cuba, it was legal. It wasn't illegal. It wasn't considered a drug. It was a hormone. So my father had to come. Not that my father wanted me to take this or anything, but my father at the time, with the knowledge that he had to explain to my mom that it was okay. The vitamins. These are what the athletes in Cuba take.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Vitamins. He actually called it vitamins.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's funny. So if that's your mentality, then it's okay.
Right, right. He didn't think
it was. It wasn't illegal.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't illegal. So seeing my dad, I thought that you had to work out to be a man.
Yeah. So when did you actually get into working out yourself?
Well, I experimented doing push-ups and all that when I was 8, 7, and 9, but it wasn't into and move. Here to Miami to our second or third home here, or second or third neighborhood, where we had a bunch of kids, and there was an older kid at the end of the block who wanted to be a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
His father had just died, so he was taking care of his mom, and he was more disciplined than all of us. Obviously he was older. He was 14 at that time or 15. We were 9.
Okay.
And he took us to one of my buddies, Ricky's backyard with a barbell. Mm-hmm. and made us against the wall and made us do a bunch of curls. He was teaching us how to train.
Yeah.
But imagine, you know, this was one of those dudes that he put as much weight as possible, do 1,000 reps, as many steps as possible. And after that, the experience was not fun.
Yeah.
And I never tried it again for a few years later. I think until I was 13, it's the next time I tried it, you know.
Okay.
I didn't seriously start a routine that I followed until I was 14 years old.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, but I did try it a few times at 13, but I gave up. I gave up because the experience was not fun. You know?
Yeah. Now, did you know anything about bodybuilding when you started, or did you just want to build up your body?
No, what had happened, John, I had gotten sick. I had gotten sick. I was always the shortest kid on the block and the youngest. And they used to call me Chiquitín. Chiquitín means short.
Okay.
And I had gotten sick. At that point, I was weighing 114 pounds. I was 14 years old. And I was throwing up for like a week. Not a week. I don't know. A few days. And I had diarrhea along with it.
Okay.
So I went down from 114 pounds. I wasn't training yet. I went down from 114 to 107 pounds. I was 4'9", 4'10" at that time. And so my mom took me to the doctors, and I was very skinny. And the doctor had recommended to my mom that I start doing pull-ups
okay.
at home to build muscle.
Okay.
So my mom bought me those pull-up bars that you put in the doors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's how it began.
Okay.
And then, so I did that for a few weeks, and I started putting my weight back on, not because I was building muscle, but because I wasn't throwing up anymore, and I didn't have diarrhea anymore. So my natural weight came back. And then from there, I had a friend named Oscar who was middle class. His father used to lift weights, and now I remember that. His father used to train in Cuba, and I think he even competed in Cuba. And he was middle class. They had some money, and Oscar had the Joe Weider set on his backyard.
Okay.
And that's where I started training with him on his backyard. And we did that for a few weeks or a few months. I'm not going to say a few months because he quit relatively fast, and I was upset because I wanted to continue.
Yeah.
And I somehow I must have picked up magazines either at his house and or my house or somebody's house, and I read somewhere, I remember vividly reading that to see any change, you had to give yourself, when you start, you had to give yourself a minimum 3 months, and you have to stick it through for 3 months.
Okay.
So when he quit, I went home, and I kept doing push-ups, sit-ups, and pull-ups, and I had some dumbbell curls, and I kept doing that. But I had promised myself that I wasn't going to quit for 3 months.
Right.
So after the 3 months, I saw results. And then the next step was, okay, now you need to do another 3 months. So now you have 6 months of training under your belt.
Right.
And that's when you're going to see the next change to your physique. And I did that. And then I saw more changes. And then my mom signed me up in it used to be called Miami Court Club, which was a health and fitness gym down here. But it was more of a racquetball place, and in that racquetball gym downstairs, they had a gym, real gym actually, and that's where I began training, and I started meeting people that were involved in not bodybuilding, but they were training and they were way more ahead of me, and there I met a kid named Alex who was 16 and I was 14, and he knew what he was doing at the time. And Alex was very strong, and it made an impact on me.
Hmm.
And Alex taught me the ropes. I'm sorry. Let me turn off the phone here.
That's all right.
Alex taught me the ropes for a few months. I think I trained with him for about four to six months.
Okay.
But then Alex ended up going the wrong way. He turned into other drugs, and he started hanging around with some bad people.
Okay.
And I didn't want to go that route. And I was younger too. I was scared of that, you know?
Yeah.
And I definitely knew I couldn't go that route. And during that particular moment, when Alex is kind of leaving the gym and not coming because he's hanging out with these people, I just happened to bump into these I got closer to these powerlifting guys that were training at the gym.
Okay.
During time. So when this kid left, or I kind of pushed them away, I began hanging around with the other powerlifters. And then those powerlifters, they really taught me how to train properly with the right form, how to build strength, and how to push the body. But it was a constant conflict because I wanted to have a physique for the girls, mm-hmm. where they wanted to be a powerlifter. And back then it was the whole bodybuilding and just bodybuilding type of thing. You know, bodybuilders and powerlifters didn't like each other.
Yeah, yeah.
So they would make fun of me because I wanted to wear a bikini and they wanted to be strong.
Right.
But I wanted to have both. I wanted to be strong and have the body.
Yeah.
So, but it was a great learning experience. I wouldn't change it. You know, I mean, they taught me how to squat, how to do the deadlifts at the time, which I didn't continue doing later on.
Mm-hmm.
They taught me how to do, behind the necks heavy. They used to do a lot of heavy behind the neck. Just a lot of the basic movements. They taught me all the basic movements.
Okay. So where'd you go from there then after you split up with the powerlifters?
So I trained with the powerlifters. I used to literally walk to the gym like 45 minutes to an hour every day.
Oh, really?
I used to walk to the gym and I used to spend 3 hours at the gym. You know, at that time, I used to spend 3 hours at the gym.
Yeah.
And they knew that I was walking to the gym. And then one day they saw how serious I was and they started picking me up,
Cool.
And then that's, I trained with them for about a year and a half. And then the first Gold's Gym in Miami opened up. And I asked my mom, Christmas was coming. We were like 4 months away from Christmas. And I begged my mom to sign me up, and she saw it kind of awkward, we didn't have money.
Yeah.
So my mom, after a few weeks, she saved her money and signed me up in Gold's Gym. I was 15 years old at the time, so she had to sign for me to sign up. I couldn't sign up. I wouldn't probably they didn't know how to sign a membership,
Right, right.
So wow. I went with my mom. I didn't drive. She signed me up, and that was it. I went to Gold's, and Gold's Gym, it's funny because at that time, I literally had three gyms around my house. I had the racquetball court gym, which was 45 minutes away. I had Gold's Gym, which was 5 blocks away.
Okay.
And then I had Porky's Gym that opened up about 2 years later, which was 2 miles away.
Okay, cool.
So I was surrounded by gyms, man. It was great. It was great. And then, so when I went to Gold's Gym, I was 15 at the time, and I already had a physique already. So that when I signed up there, people were impressed. People were impressed. It didn't impact me at the time, but I remember vividly now, like, people were like, man, you should compete. Mm. And I was like, you got to get in a bikini. I can't do that.
Yeah.
And people started seriously pointing out that I should compete. And then I met Julio Del Rio, which I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
Julio Del Rio was the one that finally convinced me to compete. And the Southern States, the Team Southern States, or the Men's Southern, the Southern States, which is by the show was being held by Peter Potter. Julio Del Rio convinced me, and it was 4 weeks away, 3 weeks away, and I ended up dieting for 3 weeks.
Okay.
I had never done a diet before. Prior to that, all I was eating was high-calorie food. I had no knowledge about food. I thought all I knew was that I needed to consume high calories to put weight. So what I was eating was I don't even think McDonald's, Burger King. I used to eat Burger King every day.
Yeah.
And Kentucky Fried Chicken and TV dinners. Because yeah. They were high calories. I had no knowledge of calories. So I would look at the back of a TV dinner and I saw that I had, 1,600 calories, 1,800 calories, and I would consume that.
Yeah.
So then Julio Del Rio puts me on a diet, eat boiled chicken and dry plain potatoes with mustard. and it was an experience, First time you put that food in your mouth, you're like, what the heck?
Yeah.
But then I learned from the other bodybuilders that this is what you have to do to put on muscle,
Right.
So I did that for 3 weeks. I entered the Team Southern States. I was 16 years old, young 16, and somehow, some way, I ended up winning.
Wow. So what'd your physique look like then, George?
I guess a skinny 16-year-old, but with symmetry. I had a pretty body, a nice little body, and I think I was a showman up there, like I wanted to be seen, and I did things that I think I did a lot of things that people didn't do. For example, I had a gentleman named Eddie Nieves, who won Mr. Florida at the time, who was a middleweight. And he told me, he goes, George, if you want to make it in this sport, if these judges don't like you, then you ain't going to win. So you make sure when you get off the stage, after you compete, you shake hands with all of them.
Yeah.
So little silly things like that I did, that I don't think anybody would do.
Right.
So when I got off the stage, I was so hungry for success. I went and I shook hands with every single judge. Right. And they're looking at this kid, imagine, they're looking at this young boy like,
yeah.
This kid is hungry for, he's hustling.
Now you're 16 and you win the Teen Southern States. Were you beating the 18 and 19 year olds too at that time?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it was different. Like we spoke a few weeks ago, I was competing against teenagers, like other kids. It's not like today where you're competing against two or three kids.
How many teenagers were in that show? Do you remember?
I can't remember, John. I think 40-something. I know 40-something, but it's nothing near to what, what we spoke about the other day. When you competed, there was 100 kids in the show.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's what I told you the other day. I'm from Chicago, and I did 10 teenage shows between 16 and 19. And 1 year, I did the Teenage Illinois, and they had it in age groups instead of height classes. And they had the 14 to 16-year-old kids in one class, 17 and 18 in one class, and then the 19-year-old kids were more advanced. They were in their own class, and they would pull in 85 to 100 teenagers in that show.
That's just crazy, man.
I remember the first year I did it, there was 40 guys in my class. 40 guys in my class.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah. I've heard those stories, and I know they're true, I use this pictures of them. Actually, I've seen the list of competitors. I forgot who posted it, 6 or 8 months ago, but 1979. I forgot what show it was. And there was like 70 kids on a show, teenagers on a show. And I was like, wow, that's amazing,
Yeah.
And, it's a shame, that the sport of teenage bodybuilding has died. Because it's what made me, and I put a lot into it. I've always felt that although I didn't continue competing later on because I wanted to do certain things with my life, I always felt that other teenagers never gave back to the sport, you know?
Yeah.
To keep it alive. And I always felt like I was one of the last few. And I always felt that because I didn't continue as a pro bodybuilder, that I always felt like, you know what, I need to speak up on this and give, you know, keep it around me if I can, you know, like help promote it a little bit. And I always felt like I need to, I'm like a role model, you know, for the teenagers. Because all the other teenagers, the one, the Teen USA, the Teen Nationals, they all went on to turn pro and continue with their lives. But then all they did was promote the pro.
Yeah, they didn't promote the teenage. Right?
I'm Mr. Olympia, I'm Mr. USA, I'm Night of the Champion winner, but they never mentioned the history of the teenage stuff.
Yeah.
And so I took advantage of that. I saw when I won the Teen USA and the Teen Nationals, many years later, when I came back and I started promoting myself, I said, you know what, there's nobody promoting that stuff, man. And I always felt like somebody needs to, and if they're not going to do it, you know what? That's fine. I'm going to put my 2 cents in and do what I can, just like you're doing with your show where you're going back and trying to, you know.
Talk about the old days.
Give credit to where credit is due to all these old-time bodybuilders that helped develop the sport.
Right.
Because now people forget where this came from. So if these guys are not going to promote and help the sport of team bodybuilding, which I think pretty much right now is done and over with, I told myself, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I go, you know what? It's going to be me then, you know?
And George, why do you think today the teenagers don't compete in bodybuilding? Like when you and I competed, when we were teenagers, there was a lot of teenagers competing.
I think it just started getting out of control. I think the bodybuilders began to get way too big. Mm-hmm. I think the drugs started getting out of control. I believe I got out of the bodybuilding scene when Dorian Yates came around. I told myself, you know what? I'm not going that route. It's just too much. There's too many chemicals you got to take, and I'm scared. So I was already involved in it. I'm already a kind of a young adult, 20, 21. Where I can make my own decisions, and I even told myself, I go, you know what? Enough. I'm not going that route.
Yeah.
That was just too much. So if it was scary for me that I was already involved in the sport, I can't even imagine a 16-year-old kid saying, oh, I'm going to take all these steroids for the next 15, 20 years to try to turn pro.
Yeah.
To try to make a living, and the living that you make out of it is really peanuts, you know?
Yeah.
My first year in business, I made more money than Mr. Olympia was making.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, so, I agree with you. I think the role models is what makes the guys on top, that's what inspires the teenagers to either compete or not compete. And I think when you and I were younger, we looked at Arnold and Robbie and Mike Mentzer and those guys, and they looked like superheroes, you know, and we wanted to look like that. There was not just me. There was a lot of teenagers out there wanting to look like that. And that's what inspired us to go to the gym and build our physiques and then start competing. And that's why you had so many teenagers competing. And now I think when they look at the guys, they're so, like you said, they're so big and they're so overdeveloped, really. It's not really an appealing look, I think, to a lot of people, a lot of teenagers, and they don't want to look like that, so they don't want to compete.
Right, and that's why you don't have – and again, I don't want to sound like an old man, because every new generation, the old generation says, oh, this new generation is not as good. But the truth is that if you don't have that young crowd coming up, you have less talent pool coming up.
Yeah, yeah.
When you look at the pool of bodybuilders today, there's 5 guys, that's it. If you look at the pool of bodybuilders in the 80s, there were 20 guys that you wanted to be like.
Yeah.
And there was 20 more coming up every year.
Yeah, yeah, right.
They were coming up, you know, 20 guys up there and a bunch of new talent coming up around the world.
Right.
There's 5 guys up there right now. There's not another 5 guys coming up anymore.
Yeah. And if you look at all the best bodybuilders from the 80s, they were all teenage champions. Lee Haney, Mike Quinn, Eddie Robinson, Sean Ray, all those guys, man. Rich Gaspari, they were all teenage champions.
Rich Gaspari, not Mike Christian, Rich Gaspari, Mike Quinn.
Yeah.
They were all, you know, all the great bodybuilders from the 80s were all teenage champions.
Right, right. And I remember the Teenage Mr. America every year. It was like, I used to look at the magazines. I'm like, oh my God, these guys are freaks.
It was like we spoke the other day. I used to go to sleep every night. And man, it's beautiful to have dreams like that. Man, I used to go to sleep like a little kid, man. Like just dreaming of being something special, man. Right. I really like. I don't want to sound like corny.
Yeah.
But I think many of us that are into this bodybuilding thing that became something. We all used to, I don't know. Did that happen to you? You used to dream of that stuff?
Yeah, all the time. I was obsessed. Yeah.
Yeah, like you know, before you go to sleep, you're thinking like. And you think you know what's on the magazines, man, you know, know, winning a trophy. It's hard to explain, man.
Right, right.
I tell you why, when I got out of the sport, I was lost, man. I was, I got depressed, man. I was lost. I had no clue who I was.
Right, right.
I missed this so much. I missed, but I needed to get out, you know. Mm-hmm. I knew I had a time period for myself, you know.
Oh, okay. And,
I had a time period for myself. I told myself if by the age of 21 I wasn't making money, I was gonna get out and make a life for myself.
Yeah.
And
tell that story about when you were in school and you went to the principal's office.
Then I went to the principal. Oh, that's right. So I was. In fifth grade, I had gotten in trouble with a teacher, and he had sent me to the principal's office, and over something I don't even want to tell you what I did, you know, but it was bad, and he sent me to the principal's office, and on the way back, I was walking back to my classroom again. I don't know if it was fifth or sixth grade. I believe it. You know what? Now I remember it was sixth grade. And I was teary-eyed, and I was lost, you know, I didn't like to be told what to do. And in that specific moment, walking back to the classroom alone, I told myself, I'm like, what am I going to do with my life? You know, I don't like to listen to people. And that particular moment, I told myself, I'm going to work for myself because I don't like to be told what to do, and I like to be a leader. I like to tell people what to do.
Yeah, right.
And I literally, John, which is not something that I'm proud of. It's just the way that my life turned out to be. But yeah. I, from that moment on, I gave up in school, man. I didn't study after that. I went from getting C's to getting F's, three F's. I literally gave up. The teachers would give me an exam, and I would just put the wrong answer on purpose and turn it in like that. I just did not care, and they would still pass me at the end of the year.
Really?
Huh. Yeah, that's how it was back then.
Yeah.
Back then, being dumb and bad was cool. Not today, though. Not today, man. So I'm not proud of it. But it's just the way that my life turned in. But I knew that I was never going to work for anyone. I knew that day I was never going to work for anyone.
Yeah. And so now when you won that Teenage Southern States when you were 16, didn't you win also the Most Promising Award? Because every year at that contest, they give the Most Promising Award to the person that has most potential, they think.
Yes. So that show, again, I had no clue what even the Most Promising man, it didn't really mean anything to me. Now I look back and I go, okay, now I get it, you know?
Right.
So I won my class and I won the Most Promising Award at the show, and people were amazed by it. I wasn't. I was just happy, you know? I didn't know what it meant, you know?
Yeah.
So now, I felt a little bit more confident. I'm like, man, I like this stuff, you know? It's cool, you know? I'm not going to be a bodybuilder, but it got my attention, you know? Let's do it again.
Yeah.
So I ended up entering a show down here called the Gold Coast,
okay,
which was 4 to 6 months later. And there was a kid that was super hype. His name is Sean Lopez, which we're still friends to this day. Sean Lopez had won the Teenage Mr. Florida.
Okay.
And he was like the big thing down here. And he had quads and sweep and biceps. He knew how to pose. And so he was like the star, and they were pumping him up. And he came to train in my gym to peek and to look at me. Mm-hmm. But I had no, I had no clue that this is how this worked, you know. Yeah. But Sean had it hard. I was living at home. Sean, from what I remember and what he told me, because we talked and we became friends many years later, Sean, I believe he didn't have a mom and dad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he lived on his own since he was like 16, 17.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. Sean drove to the gym. I guess he was paying for his own car and rent. And he drove to the gym to see me. And we didn't speak because I was nervous. And he trained somewhere around, you know, inside the gym, somewhere in the corner of the gym. He was peeking at me. And I was nervous as shit, you know. And so we competed at the show. At that show, there were, if I remember, there was 22 kids in that weight class.
Wow.
22, yeah. I'm a lightweight at that point. Lightweight.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I ended up beating him. And there I looked much better, but I'm only 16, I'm 16. So I won. There I dieted 12 weeks, you know, I'm learning how to diet, nothing crazy. Then I won that show. And immediately when I get back, you know, now I'm a star in the gym, you know, I got all my buddies in Gold's Gym, they're all shaking my hands. And I had a ton of friends and support at the gym.
Yeah.
Which I love, you know, I love that time in my life, going to the gym and having 1,000 friends, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the best. And people pushing you, you know? But along with that, which is something that we talked about the other day, you have a lot of people talking negative behind you because there's kids and teenagers and even adults that they some envy the I don't know, they see you win and they kind of envy that or they talk bad, you know. And so I got home. Now I'm like a star in my local area. They're putting me in some magazines, local magazine. I think I appear in my first national magazine, more than likely. They probably put a clip of me on ESPN and American. What was the name of the show? American Muscle.
Yeah.
And then, so then I'm like, now I'm hooked. You know, I win two shows in a row. And I read in Florida Muscle News magazine, which is like a little newspaper magazine. I read Teenage Mr. USA coming to Florida. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm gonna do that. And it was about 8 months away.
Okay.
And I trained my ass off, and with the knowledge that I had, I did not know who was competing there, but I wanted to win. Obviously, I had no clue what I was gonna do. You know,
right.
Maybe I placed top 10. You know, about a month away, I started hearing about Dennis Newman, Bo Matlock. And I don't think I heard about anybody else that really scared me. I think those are the kids that scared me the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were being promoted by Lou from American Muscle Magazine. They were being promoted by them.
Okay.
So I ended up entering that show, and I ended up winning my weight class with, like, perfect scores.
Hmm. Were you a middleweight then, George?
What's that?
Were you a middleweight?
No, I was a lightweight.
Still a lightweight, okay.
Still a lightweight. And then the overall was between me and Dennis Newman. And then we went down for the overall. Bo Matlock was in there too. He won the light heavyweight, who went on 2 years later to win the Mr. USA.
Right.
Dennis Newman ended up winning the USA 3 years later.
Okay.
Bo Matlock actually beat him in the Mr. USA.
Yeah.
And Dennis ended up beating me for the overall. He ended up beating me by 2 or 3 points from what I recall. That's what people were telling me.
Okay.
Going back, I think that year on here, I have my notes here. We're talking about 1989. In 1990, Florida Muscle News gave me the Bodybuilder of the Year award.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and the Teenage Bodybuilder of the Year award.
Right.
And, but that's 2 years later, so let's not go back to that. So then after winning the Teen USA, I'm like, wow, I win the Teen USA. I get back to school. I'm in 10th grade. People are admiring that. And I'm like freaking out, you know. Now mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, now I'm in TV, I'm in the magazines.
Yeah.
And you could feel people are talking about you, you know, when you're walking down the hallway, right. You know. And so now my ego, my head is up here.
Yeah.
You know? My head is blown up this big, but I had to stay focused, you know, because I'm doing this because I love it. I'm not doing this because of the ego.
Right.
But I knew that you have to have some type of ego to be good at it, you know. You have right. to have... You have to have that to become good at it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get obsessed. You have to have an ego. You have to have a chip in your shoulder. And so I fed off of that a little bit. Maybe too much at times. So now after winning the Team USA, I knew that the Team Nationals was a year away. And I knew that I had a year. And I wanted to be – I had read that Frank Santarello – I think was the youngest one to ever win it at 18.
Okay.
Yeah. Frank Santarelli won the Team USA at 17 and the Team Nationals at 18, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
But I think he won the overall in both.
Yeah.
I think he won the overall in both. So anyhow, so I wanted to tie him and win the Team Nationals. So, but I would look at these physiques in the magazines. I would look at Frank Santarelli's physique, and I would look at Sean Reyes. I would look at Eddie Robinson. I'm like, dude, these guys look like freaks, you know?
Yeah, like pros.
They look like pros. I think they were even, some of them were even trained by Perillo Performance. What's his name? John Perillo?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was trained at Franco Santarelli. I know that because I interviewed Franco.
Wow. And then Eddie Robinson came from a farm, from the cattle.
In Ohio, yeah.
Unbelievable, man. He used to come out on the cover of the magazines and some teenage champion, Mr. America, teenage Mr. America or whatever.
Yeah, he was a freak.
But so that year, we're talking about 1990 now. And I have a whole year to train for the Team Nationals.
Okay.
And like we spoke the other day, I think my off-season weight was no more than 185, 186. I was light, you know. I wasn't a big guy at the time. I was a teenager. I was 18 years old.
Right.
I used to grab 385 in the squat. No, 365. What's 3 plates and 50? 365. I used to grab 365, do a few reps of that, maybe like 8 reps. Strip it down to 315, do like 10 reps, strip it down to 285, 225, 185, 225, and all the way down to 135.
Right.
That was one set, and I would do that like 6 times. And I wanted to make sure that when I would train, that I was training the hardest in the country. And I made sure that every single day when I would leave the gym, that I knew that in my heart that nobody was training harder than me.
Right.
Because I literally had to feel that. There was a fear that I didn't know what somebody else across the country was doing. I didn't know if somebody else was harder than me. So I needed to make sure that I was doing everything possible. I needed to know. And I could honestly tell you that nobody was training harder than me when I was training for the Team Nationals.
Yeah, wow.
And the other thing that I did differently was, John, that we spoke about was that back then a lot of the kids used to compete in a lot of shows. But I was reading the magazines, and a lot of the pros were only competing once or twice a year. They didn't want to damage their body or their joints. And I thought that maybe that was the smarter route for me, you know. Focus for a whole year, train really, really hard, make a lot of changes, and then boom, show up.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's what I did. I trained for a whole year and showed up. And mind you, I was doing all of this alone. I had a training partner in the gym.
Yeah.
I was doing my diets myself. I knew how to diet. Like, I became like an expert at it.
Okay.
It's not hard. All you gotta do is count calories, carbs, and protein, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And keep track. Where you lose track is, I think, you become obsessed. You start looking in the mirror and you stop seeing what you're supposed to be seeing.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard, you know? Like, after a while, you look at yourself and, like, man, I don't look that good. When you do look good. And that's when you really do need an eye.
Yeah, yeah.
But the diet is just counting calories and the cardio. Okay, I'm eating this many calories. How much cardio do I need to do, you know?
Right, right.
You
mentioned steroids earlier, George. Were you using them also as a teenager?
Of course. We were all using steroids as a teenager.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I'm not proud of it. I don't think any of us are. Maybe, I mean, but it is what it is, you know. It was part of the sport. And, you know, a long time ago, I had a friend of mine that told me, you know, George, when it comes to that, don't lie, because people will look at you and they'll know, you know.
Yeah.
So I.
And the culture back then, the 80s, or 80s, early 90s, I mean, they were around back then. A lot of people were taking them in the gyms and stuff.
Yeah, but it was kept quiet. Like, it wasn't like.
Yeah, like, it wasn't like people brag about it. Yeah.
Like nowadays, it's become like a recreational drug, I think. Like,
yeah.
People take it to look fit. And right. It wasn't about that back then. Back then, it was just about competing. And when you stop competing, you would take your time off, your 3-4 months off.
Yeah.
And you would do your little cycle.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and then the amount of drugs that you would take back then was nothing.
Right, right.
You know, what I would take in a week is what you take in a day today.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
You know,
what was that like doing the team nationals then? You trained all year for it and you knew you trained super hard and, you know, nobody was training as hard as you and you dieted down and you knew the diet by this time. So what was that experience like?
Well, it was amazing. So I went with my friend Mo, who was my training partner. And like I told you the other day, I had no clue how I was going to do. I knew that I trained hard. That I knew.
Yeah.
And I remember vividly, my friend Mo is speaking. We're in the weight room, on the weighing ourselves at the weight scale, and Mo is outside. He can't come in. Other teenagers are weighing themselves. Mo can't come in. He's speaking through the door.
Okay.
And I'm nervous. I'm looking at everyone, and I go to weigh in. And when I go to weigh in, I take off my jogging pants, whatever I had on, and my shirt, and I'm standing in a weight scale, and I'm weighing 162, 160. I think, you know what? Now I remember it was 162 pounds I weighed in, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm light. But light, I'm a light guy. I was a light guy. I always felt uncomfortable being so light, but it is what it is, you know?
Yeah.
The other guys that were heavier, they weren't as lean as I was.
Right.
So after I weigh in, I look to the door and I see Mo peeking in and he's smiling, you know? And I'm like, what the heck is he smiling at, right?
Right.
So then when I step off the weight scale and I turn around to grab my shirt from the bench to put it on, I see all the kids are looking at me. And it was at that moment that I realized that they're looking at me because I guess I look good.
Yeah.
And my confidence is going up. I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm going to blow these guys away. Right? But I'm going, it can't be, you know, I'm going to win this, but it can't be. So when I walk out the door and I see Mo tells me, you're going to win this shit. I'm like, why? He goes, you're going to win this. Cause he was looking at everyone.
Right.
He walked outside of the hallway, I shook his hand and we walked back to the room. He goes, dude, you're going to win this shit. And I'm like, you know, there's no way, you know,
right.
but then I always look back and I remember when I went to put on my shirt after I weighed in, everyone was looking at me. And I guess they were looking at me because I was, maybe I looked better than them, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So tell me about the show. How was the experience of winning the Team Nationals?
You know, the Team Nationals, it was amazing, John. I remember the moment I won, you know. I remember I was doing this pose on the floor like this.
Yeah.
And with my head up. And I remember there was a smile, and it was captured on photograph. I have the picture of it and everything. I post it on Facebook every once in a while. And it's me like this, looking down with a smile. And it was the moment that I realized that I was going to win.
During your routine? During your posing routine?
Yeah, during the routine. Wow. I was nervous doing my routine, but then all of a sudden, this rush of confidence I literally felt the rush going through my legs. I swear,
wow.
John. Through my legs, through my waist, and I felt it go up through here.
Wow.
And this rush of confidence, and then I smiled, and it was in that moment I knew I was going to win.
Wow, that's great.
And, yeah. So I won my class, then we went for the overall, and there was this big kid that I hadn't seen who did give me a challenge. He was heavy, but he was very heavy from the waist up. you know, big with that. Oh, what I remember was that he had like these big stretch marks, you know. He looked like a man.
Yeah.
Big stretch marks, 221 pounds, I think, 222. But he didn't have a pretty physique at all.
Yeah.
I think he was bow-legged too. You know, we went for the pose. I ended up beating him, and I won the team nationals.
Yeah.
But it was a different time. It was a time where girls also competed. There were teenage girls competing in this show too, believe it or not.
Yeah, right.
I believe, I don't know if it was that year Alfie Newman won or the year before. Alfie Newman, who ended up getting that contract with Metrics like a year or two later. I think Alfie Newman was the first fitness star. I believe she won, what was it? I don't know if it was like a first fitness Olympia or something like that. Look her up when we finish.
Okay. Yeah, I remember her name. I remember her name.
Alfie Newman. Cute little girl, blonde hair.
Yeah.
She's powerlifting too.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, I remember her. Yeah.
Alfie Newman. She was a star. She became a big star. She used to come on TV all the time. But it was a different time. I loved it. It was. Imagine now. Now I'm a teenage national champion after I won the Teen USA. Now I have two titles.
Right.
Not one, you know. Now George's head blows up like this. So my ego now.
How old were you when you won the Teen Nationals, George?
What's that?
How old were you when you won the Teen Nationals? 18
or 19? I won the Teen Nationals at 18. I won the Teen Nationals at 18. But it was amazing, but I still had more to accomplish, you know. This thing was feeding my ego. My head was blown up, but I kept it on the check, you know.
Yeah.
I had a big, powerful mind back then. I remember when you channel all your energy into something, your mind, it just gets so strong. When we spoke about this the other day, I felt so strong at times that I felt like run through a wall and the wall was going to go down before I did.
Yeah.
I felt like I could cross the street, a car could hit me, and the car would get dead before I would get it. I felt like I could lift objects with my mind. That's how strong I felt.
Yeah.
And I fed into that. Like I fed it. I wanted to see how strong I was.
But you were strong though too, right?
Yeah, I was very strong. I did a 192 coming back from the beach after spending 6 hours on the beach, went dehydrated, went to the gym, and I did a 485 bench.
Wow. As a teenager.
I'm 19.
Jeez.
But like we spoke, the real beast is Eddie Robinson, who did 620, I think. At 19 at 210.
Unbelievable, man. Yeah, people forget how crazy Eddie was, how big he was.
And Eddie Robinson,
as a teenager.
Eddie Robinson was shirtless, you know? There was no suit or double suit or triple suit and straps, you know? That's after drinking a container of milk, probably.
And
a pound of cheese, you know?
A six-pack of beer.
that was a different time, you know?
Yeah, crazy.
Now you got guys lifting 700 and 1,000, but they're wearing four, you know,
rubber-made
suits,
right.
You know?
Right.
The rubber-made suit puts on, it can lift 200 pounds for you.
Right. So you win the Teen Nationals at 18, so then another year you're still a teenager, so what did you do then?
So.
Because you couldn't go back to the Teen Nationals.
No, I couldn't go back to the Teen Nationals because during that time, you just couldn't compete in a show twice, a show that you won.
Right.
And it wasn't good either because the idea was that if you compete in the show and you win twice, you're taking the opportunity to let another kid win.
Yeah,
you know, because these teenagers only had a short window of competition, from 16 or 17 to 19.
Yeah.
And you finish competing at 19. You can't compete as a teenager when you're 20.
Right.
So the idea back then was, you know, listen, you're done, man. You already won. Let some other kid win. And it was completely acceptable. So now I have over a year left as a teenager, and I'm looking around now. You know, something weird happened to me. After I won the Teen Nationals, I remember asking this man that I looked up to, I'm like, man, it's hard to stay motivated. I picked up right away. But I feel like I had accomplished what I wanted to accomplish.
Yeah.
And I felt I was on top of the world. And I remember asking this man, I was like, man, how do you stay motivated now? Because I don't look up to anyone now anymore. The people that I used to look up to, I beat them. And I accomplished. Well, now you're going to stay self-motivated, George. This is you now. You got to play you know, mind tricks. Not that I wasn't self-motivated to go to the gym, but how do you motivate yourself to set all the goals and keep accomplishing that? So he told me, okay, so you need to self-motivate yourself and create new goals. Because I was kind of lost. I'm like, okay, I won what I wanted to win. What do I do now?
Right.
So the Southern States, I talked to my best friend, Frankie, who was someone that I admire too, who was also a teenage champion. He was older than I was during this time. But he used to compete as a teenager. I think he won the Teenage Florida many years earlier, his weight class. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I go, man, what do you think of me competing in the Southern States? You know, I don't think anybody around me wanted me to do it, and I didn't feel comfortable doing it because I didn't want to make a fool out of myself. To this point, I still hadn't lost. I didn't want to like compete and put in this time if I wasn't going to come in the top 15. You know.
Yeah.
But I had nothing else to do, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to do this. There's nothing else to do.
Yeah.
I can't compete as a teenager anymore.
Right.
So I ended up, I was 19. I trained for the show. I had plenty of time to train, maybe 6 months. By this time I had put my diet together. I kind of knew what I was doing. And, I dieted for 12, 14 weeks for the show. And, I trained balls to the walls. I was terrified, of training because now I was going to compete in the men's category. I was a teenager. Competing in the men's category, and my goal was just to place top 12, you know. Okay. I remember speaking with Peter Potter, I'm like, man, if I get 12, 13, 14, I'll be happy with that, you know. But I don't want to place out of the top 15, you know, putting all this work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. And so I trained, I put in the time, the diet for this show, for some reason, I was in a different mindset. The diet and training was a little bit, they were both hard, but I was in a different state of mind, so it was simpler. Like, I was able to enjoy it a little bit more. Like, I was happier during the phase of the training versus the team nationals. I felt like I was, like, starving and training twice a day, cardio twice a day.
Right.
And so the show came, and I entered as a middleweight at 164 pounds. And Frank Sane tells me, you're going to win the whole show after I weighed in. I remember weighing in, and I tell Frankie, man, I only weigh 164 pounds. And he said, that's nothing, George, it's what you look like. Because back then we didn't go by the mirror.
Right.
And we didn't go by the weight scale. We went by the mirror. So I tell Frankie, after I weighed in, I'm like, man, Frank, this is light. I'm paranoid. I'm competing in the men's category. These guys are going to weigh 176 pounds.
Yeah.
He's like, George, you look amazing. It doesn't matter what your weight is. It's what you look like in the mirror.
Right.
And as a true bodybuilder, it's not about the weight. It's about the mirror. The mirror tells you whether you look good or not.
Right.
Obviously, I couldn't tell if I looked good or not because by that time, you get blinded from the diet. And it happens to all of us. We can never see what other people see in the mirror.
Right.
So I ended up entering, and I won my weight class. And I won my weight class. And when I after the class, Frankie tells me, you're going to win the overall. Francois, who won the Arnold Classic like 2 years later.
Mike Francois.
Yeah.
He
was in the heavyweights. He got third place in the heavyweights. So I ended up beating him and whoever won the heavyweight class that year.
Okay.
So, I ended up winning the overall as a teenager
in the
category. Yeah, it was, that was unbelievable to me too. That was unbelievable.
Well, I think that's what the people in Miami still talk about you because no one's ever won the open, Southern States as a teenager. That's never been done before.
I think. And now the teenage category is gone.
It's never going to be done again. Right.
But it was a special time, man. That was a special time. But there was a little hardship on that after because the guy who was filming the show for ESPN, we had gotten in a fight like a month before. We were supposed to do a training video together. And he was supposed to fly me to California. He didn't send me my plane ticket on time. And I kept telling him, send me the plane ticket, and the contract, because I was supposed to get paid for this work that I was going to do.
Okay.
And he never sent me the plane ticket. And it was like 3 days before the shoot, and I canceled on him.
Mm.
He got upset. He was the one who used to film these bodybuilding shows and put them in ESPN.
Okay.
So when I won the show, right, he edited the audience. This is true, because the promoters told me. When the show aired on ESPN and I won, there was booing.
Oh, wow.
Right?
And he put it in there?
You know?
Yeah.
He edited the people screaming and applauding. You know, obviously you have people applauding and people screaming.
Right.
He edited it and he put everybody booing.
Wow.
And then he put on the show, some people believe George Betancourt should have won and that the show was rigged. So then the promoters ended up calling him and made him apologize on the next TV show.
Huh.
So on the next time that it aired, he had to put the real back on. People
right.
are cloudy. And he had to apologize. The producers of American Muscle apologized to so-and-so, the promoters, of, you know.
Right. Wow.
So it was crazy. I didn't find out none of this until many years later.
Oh, really?
But,
okay.
Yeah, I didn't find out that had happened. One of the promoters told me that they had called them and they had to apologize. But so all I heard was booing, right? And I heard – so then that booing got around Florida, right? All the gyms, oh, they were booing George, right? And then when I would walk into the gym, people would talk bad about me.
Damn.
And I was – yeah, man, and it crushed me, man, because people were – I was a 19-year-old boy.
Yeah, you're still a kid. You're still 19 years old.
Yeah, man. I didn't know what life was.
Right.
And so my mom, there was a lot of jealousy, and people would say, oh, George only won because he's a cute kid or because he slept with a judge.
Yeah.
Or because he has a full head of hair, he's 10. Seriously, those were the rumors. The rumors were that he slept with a judge.
Yeah.
So I would tell my mom, like, what's going on? Why are people talking so bad about me? I got to fix this. Because I would try, by that time I was a freak. I was a control freak. So I would try to fix everything. How do I fix this?
Right.
I couldn't fix it. So I would fix it by getting in fights with the people that would say this.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, like, hey, did you say this about me? And then this whole chaos, you know, in the gym. It was a constant chaos week after week after week of me approaching people, you know?
Yeah.
And people would tell me in my ear, hey, so-and-so said this and so-and-so said this. And I remember I literally sat down in my mom's bed one time and I think I broke down and cried for a minute.
Hmm.
Yeah, and my friends were telling me, George, don't worry about it. That's what people do when you're good at something.
Yeah.
People tend to talk bad about you. And
right.
It's just the way life is. Ignore it. Don't let that get to you. But
yeah.
It used to kill me. Mentally, it used to destroy me.
Yeah. It's funny how that is. I mean, I had a similar story. When I won my first show, I was much older than you. I was only 23. So I competed all these teenage shows, and I was a real dedicated bodybuilder. Never won, and then I competed at 21, I got fourth, and then 22, I got third, and then I went to the Illinois State Championships at 23, and I won, and everybody liked me because I was a nice guy, and I was a hard worker and stuff, and they're like, I hope you do good, you're going to do good this year, you're going to do good. As soon as I won, I heard all those same people, I heard like stories of all these same people that were like pushing me and like really promoting me and really excited for me. They're saying shit behind my back. I'm like, really? I can't believe it. Like any kind of success, people get intimidated by that.
It becomes like you gotta be. I guess we're young and we didn't know, but it's almost like a workplace where you gotta keep quiet and you don't talk bad about anyone. Like
yeah.
You know, like you have a business, you don't tell your employees anything because then they go and tell the other one. That's how the gym is, but that's what it should have been. But you know, it was just crazy, man.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to George Betancourt for our interview. Next week, we'll have part two of our interview with George Betancourt. And I also want to thank our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I also want to thank all you Patreon donors who are helping out the show. If you'd like to contribute and be a Patreon donor, just go to the website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, we've got the link, and you can click on that. And if you want to help support the show by donating $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever you want to do, I would really appreciate you. Also, I didn't mention this in the opening, but I do want to offer our condolences to David Paul, one of the Barbarian brothers who passed away just a few days ago. I think it was over the weekend. So I'm very sorry to hear that. Of course, the Barbarian brothers were legendary bodybuilders who worked out at Gold's Gym, and they were a real staple as part of the atmosphere of Gold's Gym. And David Paul was also a really, really good photographer, if you've seen any of his work. Another one of our legends is gone. So rest in peace, David Paul, and all my condolences to his family and friends. Okay, before we go, I do want to read this article that was sent to us by Pat Comer, and this is about Robbie Robinson. This is from the September 1979 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. It's called The Black Prince of Bodybuilding, and it was written by Jack Neary, who was a great writer back then, back in the 70s, for Muscle Builder. At the top, it says, he's paid his dues, now he's being paid back. There nowhere exists a power which does not seek to increase itself. Pierre Elliott Trudeau. It has taken a decade for Robbie Robinson to pull himself free from the torturous memory of the Vietnam War, which has clung to him like some jumpsuit of constricting necrotic skin. His muscular body is scored with strips of shiny scar tissue, but these battle graffiti of combat were minor wounds that healed quickly. It has taken a considerable longer time to extract the psychic bullets of war sunk deeply into the sensitive and not entirely invulnerable mind of this 32-year-old bodybuilding champion. If we can reach a unanimous conclusion about war, it is that no man who experiences it will go unaffected. We may monitor its physical casualties by counting body bags or measuring gauze bandages, but we'll have to venture further through uncharted geography to record its toll on men's minds. Robbie Robinson can tell you the results are not pretty. When I first got drafted in the Army, a sergeant asked me what I wanted to do in life, said Robinson in an interview. I told him I wanted to be a bodybuilder, and he sort of laughed. He said, the only kind of weights you'll get in the Army are 250 caliber machine guns. Well, I never thought I'd be sent to war, but I had an innate fear. After a year and 20 days in Nam, I was not in good shape mentally. When I finally got back home to Tallahassee, Florida, I was a wreck. I was at a Greyhound bus station there, standing beside this big bus, and all of a sudden the bus started with a roar, and wham, I hit the ground scared. It was a reflex action. I thought I was being shelled. Those who do not know Robinson, and there aren't many persons who do, often mistake his cold, unpassionate exterior in the gym and other public places as a sign of unfriendliness, of misanthropy. Good friends will pass him in the gym, their eyes searching for his, looking for a glimmer of acknowledgement. But most times, the Robinson face remains taciturn, fixed in a baleful stare. And if one can read anything into this expression, it is, please respect my silence. There will be plenty of time for chat later. It is then best to leave the space about Robinson inviolate. He has armored himself with this defense mechanism for many years. What he is protecting, of course, is in a surprisingly emotional interior, one that is seldom unscathed through some of the most routine encounters. Imagine then what a blow Army life was to 19-year-old Robbie Robinson. I was drafted as soon as I got out of high school, he said. I was sent to boot camp at Fort Benning, Georgia. At that time, I was keen on bodybuilding and I wanted to play football, but I was awed going into the service. I was the only one in my family that had ever been. After a while, Army life didn't agree with me. I had a bad attitude. I was young, recently married, and I'd never been away from my family. I couldn't deal with it. It was hard for me mentally. The sergeants were especially hard on me, I think, because I had a muscular body. As a means of relieving anxiety, Robinson would jam his fist beneath the framework of his bunk bed and try to curl the entire structure. By the time he was sent to Fort Dix, New Jersey, Robinson realized he'd better change his attitude or he'd be dishonorably discharged. It was at Fort Dix that Robinson had his first brush with physical danger. While practicing parachute jumps from a tower, Robinson's chute failed to deploy, completely hurling him 100 feet into a pit of sand. Miraculously, he was not hurt. All I remember was coming to waist deep in sand. Nobody could believe my legs weren't broken. I guess it was weight training that saved me. When word came that he would be shipped overseas, Robinson was shocked. I called my wife and I said, I won't be coming home. I'm going to Nam. She started crying. But I never thought of dying. Being there and seeing so many around me die, that scared me. Grisly images of combat still plague Robinson's dreams. Indeed, his recollection of jungle fighting in Southeast Asia is not pleasant. I remember there were guys we called night fighters. They'd take whole bottles of speed and they'd be high all the time. They'd be wound up at such a key pitch. It was like they could sense Charlie, the Viet Cong, before they even got to him. People in the gym don't know what death and pain is, but you know it over there. You'd walk along and you'd see guys you knew blown apart. An arm over there and a leg here with the shoe still on. Gross, man, but that's the reality of war. The government would report back names of guys missing in action, but actually these guys would be so ruined by syphilis and VD that they couldn't send them home. There's all kinds of stories about that sort of thing that never got back here, but it's true. Charlie was bad. He'd be soaring on opium and he'd come running out of the jungle at you and the machine guns would shoot his legs right off. And he'd still be coming on stumps. Charlie would put bounties out to get you so that it was just minute-to-minute survival. Death was always looking at you. I hear guys in the gym say, I'm tired. What is tired? They don't have any idea. Packing through the jungle days on end, that's tired. The jungle was full of terror. There were these tunnel rats and bamboo vipers. One bite and you die fast. There's a scar approximately an inch and a half long marring the skin below Robinson's right eye. Another scar about the same size surmounts the flesh of his right lower thigh. His story of how he was wounded is not for the squeamish. We were on a long march through the jungle when suddenly we were ambushed. Bullets were flying everywhere and the guys were dropping around me. I was grazed across the cheek. At first I thought it was much worse because blood was all over my face, but I was lucky. I was lying down and some guy had fallen across me, and then the shooting stopped. Charlie came walking around the body, stabbing them with bayonets to see if anyone was alive. They got to me, and I was so stiff, and I guess it looked like I was dead with all the blood. One of them stabbed me in the thigh. Oh, that hurt, but I couldn't make a whimper. That was the toughest thing I ever had to do. With the temperature in Vietnam as high as 112 degrees and the humidity just shy of that, training for Robinson was not productive. There was a shed provided for physical activity, but it was ill-equipped for weight training. Army grub was poor, and the portions meager, and the weight fell off Robinson. When I went in there, I weighed 205. When I got back, I was 185. But that didn't really bother me because I knew I could gain it back quickly. What worried me was how my wife would accept me. When I got back to the States, there were a lot of families waiting for the GIs. I was standing beside this one guy who had a lot of his face destroyed by shrapnel. When his wife came walking along, she walked right past him. She didn't recognize him. That really touched me. The whole war experience has hurt. It took me a long time to adjust, a long time to relate to people. I think just now I found myself. It took that long. Once home, Robinson found a job in a book packing company. He worked there for 6 months before moving on to the Tallahassee Democrat, where for 7 years he worked in the wire room as a copy boy. He enjoyed the job, but Robinson lived for bodybuilding. The best gym to train at was at Florida State University. I was getting good then, and the other bodybuilders there kept me at a distance. They knew I was the guy to watch. Sometimes they wouldn't let me train at their gym. I don't know why. It was in like a hangar-like structure with skylights. At night, me and my training buddies, Ira Walker and Greg Hogan, would go up to the roof of this building and break in through the skylights. We'd take one 30-watt bulb along, which gave us enough light to see, but not enough for the police to notice us. And we trained like maniacs every night. The mosquitoes there were bad. We'd be doing a set and the mosquitoes would be biting. And as soon as you put the bar down, you'd be swatting them away. It made us train faster. During this time, when Robinson was starting to win every title in the region, he became sick with pericarditis, an inflammation of the heart sac. It has caused him a great deal of suffering until a year ago when the condition eased. I still get a little pain when I'm under stress, but nothing like it used to be. I don't know all the technicalities of the problem, but as my body grew, so grew my heart. At times it would become so large that it would press up into my throat, and that was very painful. Every once in a while, I had to coast in my workouts to give the heart a rest and let it reduce in size. For me, that was hard because I don't like to baby myself. Nearly 2 years ago, Robinson suffered what he calls a heart attack. He was sitting in his Venice, California apartment when a great surge of pain in his heart stiffened him, forcing his breath to come in gasp. The sweat poured off him. And his skin color, he said, turned the shade of mustard. Elaine, his wife, rushed me off to the hospital. I was dazed. The doctors took one look at me and they started jabbing me with all kinds of needles and tubes. I was mass hysteria. I remember one nurse grabbing hold of my arm and crying out in astonishment, "Good Lord, look at these arms, he's so big." And they had a hell of a time finding a vein to stick in the IV. It seemed the blood vessels just regressed deep into the muscles. After a few hours, my condition was stable and the doctor told me that I'd have to quit training with weights and spend at least 2 weeks in bed, maybe more. That did it. Enough of that, I thought. I yanked the tubes out of my arm and I walked out of the hospital. The next morning, I was in the gym training. Nobody had any idea what had happened. For all the grief that his heart condition seemed to have given Robinson, it did not hinder his progress as a bodybuilder. After winning nearly 100 contests, Robinson stepped into the bigger arena, the 1975 AAU Mr. America in Los Angeles. Competitors, judges, and spectators were stunned to see this ebony marvel take his place on stage with some of the day's best amateurs. Outside the southeastern part of the country, Robinson was virtually unknown. Joe Reeder remembers the contest. "I was sitting there and out walked Robbie," said Weider, whose best talent is in assessing potential. "Of course, none of us knew who he was, and we couldn't believe this guy. He was so good, and then they only gave him fifth place. It seemed way off." For all the outcry by those around him, Robinson did not seem upset with fifth place. "It didn't bother me. I was so happy to get the most muscular award. I was good. But now when I look at the pictures of that contest, then, well, I look terrible compared to now. All those other guys were known, and I was unknown. I thought it was a thrill. I walked on stage, I hit five poses, and I walked off. I only knew five poses." The day after the contest, Weider summoned Robinson. An offer was made. Robinson should come west and join the Weider team. The rest, as they say, is history. "I went back to Florida after the contest feeling pretty high about the offer," said Robinson. "I was in college at the time taking commercial art. I've been divorced for a couple years. At college, I met Red, his nickname for Elaine, and I married her shortly after. She's very talented in art, specifically interior design. Well, she was entrenched in her thing there and quite close to her family, who I might add never approved of me. They thought, who is this bodybuilder and how's he going to support our daughter, who was always used to the best? But I went back there and I had my heart set on going back to California. So I told Red, you can come with me or you can stay here, but make up your mind. She took the chance with me and I'll always be grateful for that because I needed her support. When I was first out here, I didn't have a lot other than the money that Joe gave me weekly. You know, I thought that was really something because he didn't even have to do that, but I didn't know where my next meal was coming from." Robin's story is not without its element of Horatio Alger. As he reminisced during the interview in his luxurious condominium, he was constantly fiddling with various expensive bric-a-brac that decorated the table near his high-packed rattan chair. One of his favorite pieces is an antique bronze statue of Mercury, whose winged feet seemed to kick up an invisible cloud of dust. On the other side of his chair was a huge aquarium thriving with numerous species of sea life. In lordly fashion, Robinson entertained us that evening with detailed personality analyses of each fish. Elaine sat amidst a pile of cushions over a Persian rug, smiling at our compliments to the tasteful decor of the room, for it was her work. "I probably enjoyed a better relationship with Joe than any other bodybuilder," said Robinson. "We've never had a fight. Believe it or not, he treats me like a son. He gives me a lot of publicity and look around and see what it's done for me." Weider has a mutual admiration for Robinson. During a recent photo session at Gold's Gym, Weider was overheard saying, "You know that Robbie is amazing? He's the fastest learner of all the bodybuilders. You tell him once and he catches on." The Weider-Robinson marriage has been fortunate for both men. Extensive coverage in the magazine helped Robinson's mail order business grow incredibly. To manage the business and Robinson's exhibitions and seminar dates, Elaine postponed her own work in interior design. "I like bodybuilding now," she said, "but I didn't understand it at first. I didn't want to accept it. I never even heard of bodybuilding until I met Rob. I was faced with the ultimatum to go to California or stay in Florida, but I went with him because I love my husband. I definitely feel proud of him. Any woman would. He's in the public eye and women are attracted to him. I have a certain amount of jealousy, but it used to be worse. But I have the security knowing that he loves me. Handling his mail orders has set my career back. At present, I can't see getting back into it. I'm too busy. I put the marriage first." According to Elaine, 25, bodybuilding has made her a better person. There was a time when she was reclusive, and her infrequent encounters with other bodybuilding people were not always joyous occasions. But, she said, her attitude has changed, and now she enjoys traveling with Robinson. "I'm in the process of writing a 3-volume book on total physique display for the male bodybuilder," Elaine said. "I want it to be a reference book for bodybuilders, and I'll have Robbie's story too." Robbie's story is not without its moments. Under Weider's tutelage, Robinson went on to win the AFAB Mr. America and Mr. World titles before being beaten by Ken Waller at the 1975 Mr. Universe in South Africa. The next year, Robinson won the Universe in Montreal. As a professional, he has won numerous events, but in two tries, his greatest quarry, the Mr. Olympia, has eluded him. In my first Olympia in 1977, I miscalculated something and I came in puffy. I looked better a couple days later. Joe said, Robbie, what did you do? I said, I didn't know, but it's too late after the show. Losing that show upset me. In the second Olympia, the next year, I was better prepared. Maybe not at my best, though, but I couldn't win that either. Frank Zane beat me both times. Now, second is no disgrace, especially to Frank. He is a champion. I appreciate the type of body he's got. I just can't knock him like others do. He presents himself like a winner when it counts, and he wins. I watch him at all the contests when I'm up on stage with him, and I notice that he's into his own thing. He doesn't even seem to be aware of anybody but himself. Robinson is not happy with defeat. That's obvious from the post-contest funk that he slips into. But it's apparent he's done an overhaul on his attitude during the past few months. Winning is the most important thing for me, but you can't win all the time. You can pick 25,000 judges, and each one's looking at a different thing. So I do my best. I don't worry about who I have to beat because I have no control over them. And I go out there and I accept the results. My posing, or should I say my presentation, has improved so much that I'm overwhelmed myself. I feel good about what I'm doing. You know, I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'll nudge Red and I'll say, that's it. Hey, Red, I've got the weirdest movement. I live for the gym. There's no place I'd rather be but in the gym training. So I'm always thinking of new exercises to create something freaky. If it works, no matter how weird, I'll do it. It's those weird ones that make me look finished. I've got the foundation I need. Now I just want to refine my body. Robinson's training hasn't always been so eclectic. His introduction to the sport is not extraordinary. At the age of 15, after seeing Muscle Men in the comic book, he told his sister he wanted to be a big bodybuilder. She didn't know what a bodybuilder was. Without the money to buy weights or join a gym, young Robinson innovated by strapping two inner tubes to the end of a brass bed. With these, he would curl, press, and pull. And although I didn't know what I was doing, I was growing. But not without his mother's chagrin. She ran me out of the house. She didn't want me sweating on the floor she just scrubbed. So I moved my gym outside. I got a barbell made from two train wheels and I'd squat that. I cut out my t-shirts for show. All of a sudden, I had muscles. I go to the school and the kids weren't ready for that. They thought I was a freak. My football coach told me to quit or I'd be muscle bound. Now that school has loads of equipment, so it shows how far weight training has come. Robinson has always worked hard. In the summers, he helped his father at a lumber mill. At school, he was an all-state athlete in track and on the gridiron. Robinson is probably bodybuilding's most singular man. Indeed, his individualism has never even rankled some bodybuilding railbirds. A year ago, this magazine was rife with controversy about Robinson's gym attire, which usually includes cornrow braids, woolen toques, a pendant or two, a gold earring, a tattered t-shirt, and several pairs of socks. The person who cared the least about the brouhaha is Robinson, who said, hey, my dress doesn't hurt anybody. I don't bug others in the gym, so why should anybody bug me? Robinson's more interested in self-improvement. I've done a lot with my body. Now I want to make the right investments with my money. I don't want to train myself into the ground. I need something to fall back on. I don't care about being a millionaire. Even if there was no money in bodybuilding, I'd still compete. I just love bodybuilding. Every day I seem to reach a new level. I want to keep learning. I'd love to win the Olympia, but I want to win on my merits. I'm enjoying life more now, and I'm getting involved with more projects. I got my bodybuilding camps back east this summer, and that's already a great success. Yeah, I paid my dues, and now I'm enjoying the rewards. All right. Thank you to Pat Comer for sending out that September 1979 article about Robbie Robinson. That was great. Great stuff. I remember that stuff. All right. That's it for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We will see you guys next week. Take care, everybody.